Welcome to Your Health, a program brought to you by the Health Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis. In today's program, we'll hear a bit about the new recommendations on breast and cervical cancer screening, patients taking control of their medical care online, and doctors rethinking pain. But one of the big health stories this week was the news about cervical cancer. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists is changing its recommendations about how often women should get pap smears. They're saying there's no need for the test before age 21, and tests after that can be spaced out over longer intervals. NPR's Brenda Wilson explains.
The old recommendation from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or ACOG, was that pap smears should start 3 years after a girl begins having sex, or at least by age 21. But because cervical cancer is slow growing, ACOG says such early tests aren't needed. Not only that, they only have to be done every 2 years until she's 30.
The incidence of invasive cancer of the cervix in teenagers is exceptionally low. This is a cancer of women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s.
That's Dr. Alan Waxman. He wrote the new guidelines for ACOG's Gynecology Practice Committee. He says scientists now know that many young women become infected with the human papillomavirus, or HPV, that causes cervical cancer. That can cause abnormal pap smears, even though most of the time it clears up on its own. And so subjecting a young girl to a frightening test is unnecessary.
She's very, very sensitive to her body image. She goes and gets her first pap test. It comes back abnormal. Now she's confronted with the question of, do I have cancer in my reproductive organs? She has to go through additional tests, which, again, are intrusive, may be uncomfortable.
The committee wanted to avoid subjecting women to treatments that might require surgery or procedures that pose a risk to a young woman's reproductive health.
An increasing number of studies have come out showing that women who have had these treatments have an increased risk of premature births if they get pregnant subsequently. Now, most women who get treated don't have prematurity, but when you think about treatment in teenagers, they've got their whole reproductive life ahead of them.
When a woman turns 30, the committee recommends that if a woman has three normal tests, the screenings can then be done every 3 years. Dr. David Soper, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Medical College of South Carolina, says the committee started working on these recommendations in 2007.
The recommendations really are just catching up with what the science is, and that is that you do not improve cancer detection by doing annual smears in women at the various age groups. So I don't think there's any danger in this new guidance.
The greatest danger, it turns out, is to women who don't ever get pap smears or haven't had one in 5 years. They make up more than half of the 11,000 women who die from the disease in the United States. There's unlikely to be very much objection to the new guidelines in the medical community. The American Cancer Society is about to undergo a similar review, according to its deputy medical officer, Lynn Lichtenfeld, who says there isn't the same intense disagreement over pap smears as there is surrounding the issue of mammograms.
Within the cervical cancer community, experts have been working together, have pretty much have a consensus about what to do. And I think that since that's good news because it gives a fairly straightforward message to women.
There are some women who do need more frequent pap smears. Women who are infected with HIV, who have a suppressed immune system, or who have had a previous abnormal pap smear should continue to be screened every year for cervical cancer. And ACOG recommends that women should still visit the gynecologist annually, even if they're not going to get a pap smear. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
These new recommendations on cervical cancer screening came just on the heels of some big mammogram news, and we'll get to that in a moment. But first, let's talk about pain. A decade ago, the medical establishment set standards for pain treatment, but many hospitals still aren't getting it right. NPR's Patricia Naimond looks into why and what patients can do.
Check in at patient registration, and anytime before 7 o'clock in the morning.
Once settled in their room, patients here at St. Agnes Medical Center in Fresno, California, see what most patients across the country see, a display of a series of circles starting with a smiley face that begins to droop, circle by circle, until it becomes a full-blown tearful frown. Anesthesiologist Linda Hertzberg.
0 is no pain. 1 to 4 is mild pain, 5 to 7 is moderate pain, and 8 to 10 is severe pain.
Measuring pain has been coined the fifth vital sign, along with blood pressure, heart rate, temperature, and respiration. Hertzberg says when patients define their level of pain, it helps doctors target their treatment. And treating pain has advanced dramatically over the past decade, starting with the discovery that medication delivered directly into the spinal cord could stop pain signals to the brain.
There's also peripheral nerve blocks where you can, say, numb up someone's arm or shoulder or numb up their leg for a period of up to 24 hours by doing nerve blocks for, say, orthopedic procedures.
Hertzberg says most hospitals are now paying more attention to pain, but not all. Erica Thiel's 26 now. At 21, she was diagnosed with a rare genetic disorder involving an enzyme deficiency. As a result, she's had dozens of surgeries and procedures for joint, heart, brain, and spinal cord problems, and she says she's endured lots of pain in different hospitals, most recently from abdominal surgery.
I just, you know, I kept asking them if there was something different that we could do for pain control because I felt awful. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't roll from side to side. There was nothing I could do, and they just kept telling me, oh, you just need to go to sleep or try to relax. Or I spent hours that night in tears, really upset. You're almost near hysterical because nobody believes you. They basically tell you that the pain is in your head.
Thiel says it seemed like the young doctors just didn't believe her. She now goes to a pain specialist who helps coordinate her care. Dr. Lynn Webster is also a pain specialist. He runs a clinic in Salt Lake City. Webster says most doctors still aren't adequately trained in pain management in medical school. As a result, he says many don't realize that post-surgical pain, if not adequately treated, can feed on itself and become a chronic problem. And pain can actually undermine recovery.
Patients who have good post-op pain control are able to breathe better. They can take in deep breaths, which can prevent the development of pneumonia. And if they're able to get up and walk quickly, it can decrease the risk of having a blood clot in their legs that could even be lethal.
And because it's so subjective, doctors have a difficult time measuring pain. There's no lab test or x-ray that tells exactly how much pain and where. On top of that, Webster says patients respond to pain relievers very differently.
There may be a tenfold difference in our response from one individual to another with the same drug given for the same amount of pain stimulus. This is not something that has been appreciated for long within the medical field and probably is still not appreciated by most physicians who are not in our field.
Health professionals like Webster want to see the treatment and management of pain standardized in a medical specialty that's as rigorous as cardiology or pulmonology. In the meantime, Webster says patients should be proactive and sit down with their physician, surgeon, or nurse before any surgery that's not an emergency and talk about expected pain and how it can be controlled. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
When Americans go looking for information on health, they turn to the internet as one of their first sources. That's no surprise. But the way they use the internet sometimes is. NPR's Joseph Shapiro has this report.
We go online to read about some healthcare condition. That's still the most common way people use the internet for health information. But it seems almost passive compared to the way a small group of internet-savvy people are connecting online. Susanna Fox is with the Pew Internet and American Life Project.
They are posting their first-person accounts of treatments and side effects from medications. They are recording and posting those podcasts. They're tagging content. They are part of the conversation. And that, I think, is an indicator of where we could be going in the future of participatory medicine.
Fox says a recent survey by her group showed that 61% of adults say they look online for health information. There's a term for them, e-patients. And about 20% of them, the ones who are changing things, go to social networking sites where they're talking to medical experts and other patients.
The internet is not just information. There is a social life of information online. People are using all these tools to connect with friends and family, to connect with health professionals, and people are accessing a much deeper level of information now than they were 5 years ago.
Fox says patients are far ahead of doctors and hospitals when it comes to using the internet. According to a study in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, only about 17% of doctors say they use computerized medical records. Fox says a growing number of patients are tired of waiting for doctors to share information.
The patients on the vanguard who understand what's at stake are saying it's not meaningful if I can't use it.
So they're going to social networking sites that allow them to put their own medical data online. Microsoft last month introduced My Health Info, and Google has Google Health. People use these sites to enter their lab results or track their blood pressure or cholesterol over time. The sites say they take added security measures to keep private information secure. Jamie Haywood, who created another site called Patients Like Me, says people are used to tracking all kinds of personal information online, so they don't understand why they can't get the records that their own doctors can order up.
What's sad is they order all this information and they get it back from the lab, and it comes back in this rich electronic format with all this information on it. And in an ideal world, you'd be able to get that raw information just like you can on your credit card for every transaction you do in the world. But you can't in health. It's immoral.
Haywood created Patients Like Me because he was trying to find out about research advances that might help his brother, who later died of Lou Gehrig's disease. Haywood's site is still small. About 50,000 people have joined. But they come together and share personal information with others who have the same illness, such as multiple sclerosis, fibromyalgia, or bipolar disorder. Haywood says he came to see there's power for patients when they share medical information, even the most private of information. By sharing on social networking sites like his, Haywood says patients can make better choices about their own care.
The amazing shift is that if you share information about your own experience with this disease, then we can facilitate the conversation that you want to have with the person in the world who is just like you, whether they live in Vancouver, Canada, or Australia, or down the block, who's the most like you, has the same family situation, is on the same treatments, is dealing with the same side effects, to find out whether your concerns are justified, they make sense, whether you're doing the right thing. That's the transformation.
The Pew study found that 39% of e-patients already use a social networking site like Facebook, and mobile devices are making it easier. But the source patients say they trust the most remains a traditional one, their own doctor. Even a doctor who still keeps records on paper. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And now back to mammograms. If you remember, this past week, a group of leading health experts said that the average American woman can wait until she's 50 to start getting mammograms. The United States Preventive Services Task Force is also recommending that women 50 and older who have no risk factors for breast cancer can space out the exams over a longer interval instead of yearly. That news brought angry reaction by many women, and even breast cancer experts are having a hard time agreeing on exactly when and how often women should get mammograms. Richard Knox has this report.
Some people's reaction to the new guidelines was, "It's about time." One of them is Dr. Susan Love. She's a former breast cancer surgeon who runs a Los Angeles foundation dedicated to finding the cause of breast cancer.
I was never convinced that mammography screening worked that well in younger women, and have always suggested that women should start at age 50.
Love says the idea that yearly mammograms are life-saving for women in their 40s was oversold.
I'm not saying that mammography will never find cancer under 50. It can find it. The question is, when you look at a large group of women, is it finding enough cancers at a point where it's making a difference in the outcome? And the answer is, in the studies, that it's not.
But when Love expressed that view in her blog this week, it was not very popular. Have you lost your freaking mind? Wrote one 42-year-old woman. How dare you? May God help you sleep at night for the death call that you've just trumpeted. P.J. Hamill has been seeing a lot of similar messages. She's a patient advocate and a blogger for a website called Health Central Network.
I've been getting a lot of vitriol, people exploding with rage, basically. How dare they, you know, deprive me of my life or try to deprive my daughter of her life and things like that.
Hamill finds herself pulled in two directions. She knows researchers deal in statistics, but she identifies with the plight of individual women.
My heart is going out to all the women who I know will die because they follow these new guidelines. On the other hand, my mind is saying they've done the analysis, they've put these guidelines out there, they did their job.
One thing you should know about P.J. Hamill, at the age of 47, she had a suspicious mammogram. A biopsy showed advanced cancer. That was 8 years ago. Today she's fine. Hamill says mammography saved her life. So, like many women, she doesn't understand why the guideline writers place so much emphasis on the downsides of mammograms, the anxiety and unnecessary surgery that false alarms can cause.
It's almost apples and oranges. I mean, life and death is obviously very important. Whether you're worried for a few days or whether you have some needless surgery, isn't that worth your life? To me, it would be. To me, it was.
Hamill says she's going to keep telling women to get yearly mammograms, including women under 50. Robert Smith of the American Cancer Society says it's sticking with the current guidelines, too.
Because we not only have looked at the evidence that the task force looked at, but we also looked at newer, modern data.
For instance, he says a study from Sweden shows 48% fewer breast cancer deaths among women in their 40s who got regular mammograms. That's very different from the U.S. task force's estimate. It says mammograms only reduce breast cancer deaths by 15% in this age group. But Smith acknowledges that advocates may have given American women unrealistic expectations about mammograms.
Have we oversold screening? You know, we say screening saves lives, and that simple statement has been criticized as overpromising. And it does, I suppose, because we don't say screening saves lives, but beware. We want women to understand the shortcomings of screening, but we don't want them to be dissuaded from doing it.
If nothing else, the current uproar might give everybody a more realistic idea about the pros and cons of mammograms. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Here now is a conversation NPR's Melissa Block had with two doctors on breast cancer screening. First, Teresa Beaver. She's the medical director of the Cancer Prevention Center at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Welcome to the program, Dr. Beavers.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And also Baron Lerner, an internist at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. He's also author of Breast Cancer Wars, Hope, Fear, and the Pursuit of a Cure in 20th Century America. Dr. Lerner, welcome to you.
Hi, Melissa.
And Dr. Lerner, you pretty much agree with these new guidelines. Why is that?
Well, the recommendations are basically pointing out that in order to save one life from women in their 40s, you need to screen something like 1,900 women for 10 years. So that's tens of thousands of mammograms to potentially save one life. And along the way, you're going to be getting a lot of something that's called false positives. So women who have false alarms on their mammograms wind up getting biopsies and that didn't really need it. So there's a lot of potential harm along the way to potentially only save one life.
And Dr. Beavers, though, you're looking at those same numbers and coming to a different conclusion.
That's correct. I think we all will agree that there are benefits obtained with mammographic screening. There's also harms. We acknowledge that you have to screen more women in their 40s than you do in their 50s. Dr. Lerner quoted the number of 1,900, and that is correct. But you have to screen about 1,300 women in their 50s to find one breast cancer. So I'm not sure why that line is drawn between the 1,300 and the 1,900. And then there seems to be an overemphasis on the harms of mammographic screening. In my opinion, my colleagues, other clinicians that see patients, breast cancer patients, and screening patients for breast cancer, were willing to accept a number of false positives to be able to save one woman's life.
We have been getting a lot of email from listeners, as you might imagine, and a number of people have stories of their own, and I want to read a couple of those letters. This is one from Wendy Hickey of Pittsburgh, who says that 3 years ago, when she was 45,
A mammogram identified suspicious tissue in her breast. She had a needle biopsy, excisional surgery, and is now cancer-free, taking daily tamoxifen. And Ms. Hickey writes, I can't imagine what would have happened if I had delayed my mammogram for 5 more years, but I feel safe in guessing that the outcome and treatment would not have been as positive. Dr. Lerner, what would you say to Wendy Hickey about that?
If people can take away from the show the notion that what she's saying may be true but may not be true, I think they would learn a lot. What the data is showing us is that this woman, even though the mammogram found the suspicious cells early on, the argument is that her overall prognosis would not have changed. She would have gotten treated then as aggressively or more aggressively as when it was found by mammogram, and she would have done exactly the same. That's what the point is of this data. It's hard conceptual leap for people to make, even for a doctor, but that's what the data show.
And you would assume, though, that the earlier you find something, the better your results would be.
That has been the guiding principle of cancer research since the early 20th century, but the data for some cancers shows that things are not that simple, and that's what we're trying to deal with now.
Dr. Beavers, what do you think?
Well, I think it's right that the data is that way for some cancers, but not for all. In fact, a great many cancers, by finding them early, we can change the outcome. So I understand her viewpoint, and that's why I am recommending annual mammographic screening for women beginning at age 40. I think actually kind of the flip side would be when I'm sitting in the clinic and I have a woman in her 40s in front of me, she's going to turn to me and say, so doc, should I get a mammogram or not? What's going to guide me in telling her if she should get a mammogram or not based on these current guidelines? We know, in fact, that the majority of breast cancers diagnosed in women in their 40s are in women who have no risk factors. So I can't go solely based on risk factors. If I did, I would miss a number of women who will develop a breast cancer and, in fact, may be caught at a larger, possibly more advanced breast cancer.
And Dr. Lerner, if you had that same woman in your office, no family history, no special risk factors, say she's 40, 41 years old, she wants you to recommend whether she should get a mammogram, what would you tell her?
Well, I try to avoid making decisions for my patients, but try to give them the best information that I can. And I would emphasize, as we said before, the pros and cons. This is what the advocates think of this test, and this is why they think it's a good test. This is some of the downsides of this test. Are you the sort of person who would want to go ahead? Are you comfortable with a test that's not as good that might not pick up something? Or are you the sort of person who wants to avoid unnecessary biopsies at all costs? I tend to find that my patients segregate themselves into those two groups.
And if they absolutely insisted that you give them your clinical guidance on this, what you would recommend, what would you do?
Well, again, part of that would reflect my knowledge of the patient herself. But if you're really trying to pin me down into a corner, I think based on the current guidelines, I would say that a mammogram is not necessary. But if she really wants it, it's fine.
There was the other recommendation that we mentioned from this panel, that women not examine their own breasts, that the harms outweigh the benefits. And we got a lot of letters about that, too. Here's one from Tim Hart of Bothell, Washington, who writes, I was shocked that doctors are no longer suggesting self-examinations. I lost my wife to inflammatory breast cancer a couple of years ago, and if it had not been for her regular self-exams, the cancer would not have been detected as soon as it was. She found both the original case and its reoccurrence before the doctors did. If it had not been for her diligence, I would have lost her several years earlier. Dr. Beavers, thoughts on that case?
Well, actually, this is a recommendation from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force that I am in agreement with, but I want to clarify what the recommendation was. It was that women should not be taught how to do a breast self-examination. And this comes about from a large randomized trial that showed women who were taught how to do a breast self-examination, and in fact also provided reminders to do it, were no better at finding breast cancers than the women who had not been taught nor received any reminders. We do, however, recognize that women are the most likely person to find their own breast cancer. And for that reason, you have been seeing a paradigm shift in recommendations from many agencies, where now the recommendation is breast awareness. The concept is that there is no right or wrong way for a woman to find an abnormality. And in fact, the vast majority of women, when they find that problem, were not doing a formal breast self-examination, but in fact found it during showering or dressing, and it was more of a chance detection. But yes, they themselves found it.
And explain to me just a little further why it wouldn't help a woman find a lump.
Well, what it actually tells us is that people know their bodies. Maybe an analogy that I could give is, say that you found a lump on the back of your calf. You weren't doing a monthly self-examination of your calf when you found that lump. It was just something you came across by chance, and you go, oh, what's that?
I guess I'm still a little confused. What would be the harm in teaching women to examine their own breasts, to make it more routine for them to do that?
So the harms are, in fact, false positives, the same thing that we see with mammographic screening. Why I feel that we should not be teaching women breast self-examination is because there is no benefit, but there are associated harms. That actually differs from the mammographic argument, where there are, in fact, benefits and harms, and it's the balance of those benefits and harms.
Dr. Lerner, this letter from Tim Hart, the outcome for his wife was sadly still that she died from breast cancer. But he said, look, this early detection through self-examination bought them some time together.
If you think about finding a cancer in your breast using your fingers, especially one that's deep in the breast, it's got to be at least a centimeter in size, maybe even a little larger. We call that early detection, but it's not early. Most of those cancers, many of those cancers have been there growing for months or years. And we now know, in contrast to when early detection was invented, that a lot of breast cancers spread early on in their course. So the notion that finding a lump in your breast is truly early and it's before the cancer spread and therefore you're going to save a life doing that doesn't make the sense that it used to. And so in a case like this, his wife absolutely did what she did, and that I totally applaud that, and it's great that she was able to find that earlier and get informed. But again, it's not entirely clear from a story like this that she prolonged her life at all by doing it, because what was done by the time she found it, both at the original presentation and the recurrence.
You know,
and I think this case is actually a good illustration where waiting till the cancer presents clinically, on self-exam or a clinical exam, it may be too late.
You know, these new recommendations have raised all sorts of questions about whether insurance companies are going to now stop covering early mammograms for women under 50. Do you think that's a real risk, Dr. Beavers?
I do. I have concerns about it because I will be telling my patients that I'm recommending annual mammograms beginning at age 40, and of course, counseling them about the benefits and risk. After doing so, many will want the mammogram, but they may find they won't be able to access it because now payers may use this as the basis of their reimbursement, and thus only women age 50 to 74 would be able to get a mammogram every 2 years. And that will be unfortunate.
Dr. Lerner, do you think you'll see that as well?
Well, it's certainly a possibility, you know, especially in a cost-cutting environment. The notion that you now have a test that's pretty expensive that leads to unnecessary biopsies and you can save a lot of money by not paying for it is going to be an appealing notion. I do hope that people separate the science from the politics, though. I think that the current recommendations and the changes really reflect a bunch of scientists, biostatisticians getting together and trying to do the right thing and make the right recommendations as far as what the data show. What we as a country and a society choose to do with that information is really a political issue.
Dr. Lerner and Dr. Beavers, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Baron Lerner is an internist at Columbia University Medical Center in New York and author of Breast Cancer Wars, Hope, Fear, and the Pursuit of a Cure in 20th Century America. And Dr. Teresa Beavers is the medical director of the Cancer Prevention Center at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. That's all for Your Health. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. I'm Rebecca Davis.